Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Judicial Recusal Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Monday, June 8th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Caperton v. A.T. Massey Coal Company. In this case, the Supreme Court considered whether West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals Justice Brent Benjamin's failure to recuse himself from his principal financial supporter's case violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. In a 5-4 decision delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held that in the circumstances of this case, the Due Process Clause requires Justice Benjamin's recusal, reversing the decision of the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals below and remanding the case back to that court. To discuss the decision, we bring back from our post-argument podcast on this case, Capital University Law Professor Bradley Smith. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Smith.
One of the first things that you hear in law school is that hard cases make bad law, and bad facts also make bad law, and Caperton versus Massey Coal is a case that has both of those. One of the fascinating things about the Caperton case is the extent to which the facts of the case were, in fact, repeatedly misreported in the news, both before and after the case. For example, here are some excerpts from an article in the American Bar Association Journal, the ABA Journal. Now, one might expect more errors in the popular press, but you'd think the ABA Journal would take particular care to get the facts right. The ABA Journal states at various points that Blankenship was the president of Massey Coal, who spent about $3 million trying to get Brent Benjamin elected to the West Virginia Supreme Court or to defeat his opponent, Justice McGraw. In any case, the ABA Journal states, Blankenship raised some $3 million on behalf of an unknown Charleston lawyer named Brent Benjamin, who wanted a seat on the West Virginia court. It states, concerned that seven figures in campaign backing could influence the case's outcome, Caperton's lawyers asked Benjamin to disqualify himself. The ABA goes on to state, the justices will ponder whether Benjamin violated Caperton's 14th Amendment due process right by accepting millions in campaign support from Blankenship, then deciding the case anyway. They quote the ABA's own amicus brief in the case, saying the magnitude and timing of the campaign contributions gave Justice Benjamin an appearance, if not in fact, a personal interest in the outcome of the case. Blankenship also contributed $515,000 in direct support to Benjamin's campaign committee. And finally, their article stated other donors chipped in the remaining $330,000 the committee raised. Now, in fact, every one of these statements is either very misleading or, more often, outright false. For example, Brent Benjamin, the alleged beneficiary of all this spending, was not unknown. He had been the state treasurer of the West Virginia Republican Party for 2 years. He had been an attorney for 19 years at one of the state's largest law firms. He was frequently mentioned as a possible candidate for the Supreme Court. He was supported by the party in a primary for the Supreme Court. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce had rated the race as one of the 10 most important Supreme Court races of the year nationwide, and numerous reports indicated that it would decide the direction of the court. So Benjamin was not a newcomer or a total unknown by any standards. In West Virginia, he was probably one of the best-known Republicans in the state. Additionally, Benjamin was endorsed by every newspaper in the state except for one. And despite having spent 4 decades in West Virginia politics, Benjamin's opponent, the incumbent Justice McGraw, had received only 56% of the vote in a Democratic primary that year. Now, it should be noted as well, Blankenship did not raise other money on behalf of Benjamin. Benjamin did not accept campaign support from Blankenship. In fact, he really could not reject Blankenship's spending. Blankenship's spending in the race was independent spending, that is, spending done without request, without coordination with, without the approval or disapproval of candidate Benjamin. It was simply Blankenship's decision to spend the money. So there's no way that Benjamin could have refused, so to speak, the spending, even if he wanted to. Blankenship did not make $515,000 in direct support to Benjamin's campaign, as the ABA said. Rather, he contributed $1,000 to Benjamin's campaign, the legal maximum. Other donors contributed not $330,000, as the ABA reported, but over $840,000 to Benjamin's campaign. So what causes this kind of confusion? Well, much of it is the arcane and complex details of campaign finance law, but this area of law is complex precisely because of constitutional decisions by the Supreme Court, constitutional decisions that have held that the difference between independent spending, as Blankenship did, and contributions to a campaign is of constitutional magnitude. So in any case, the case is one in which what is going on, the buzz in the legal community, which of course I think justices and clerks and so on are aware of, the editorials in the newspapers and so on, are consistently making this case look absolutely terrible. John Grisham then takes the case and uses it as the basis for a novel. But of course, Grisham's book is fiction, and he enhances the facts and make them look worse than they were. So I think the case got to the court with a feeling that this was just a beyond-the-pale scenario where something had to be done. And the question was, should Justice Benjamin have to recuse himself from a case involving not Blankenship, the man who spent the money, but Massey Cole, the company for which Blankenship was the chief executive? And we are left with a scenario in which Benjamin has himself done nothing that would normally give anybody any reason to think he had acted improperly. He did not know Blankenship or any of the other litigants. He made no improper comments on the case. He had no direct pecuniary interest in the case. And so this was the situation that the court faced. Is it a constitutional violation of due process if Benjamin did not recuse himself in the decision? In the end, by the way, Benjamin cast a vote with a 3-2 majority, so his could be viewed as the deciding vote, to overturn a jury verdict against Massey Cole, and therefore a jury verdict that had been in favor of the plaintiff, Caperton, a smaller coal producer there in West Virginia. Now, I say the hard cases make bad law. I've expressed that this is a hard case, and it's one that may have appeared much harder than it is, but they have a tendency to make bad law because it is such an extreme and unusual case. And to some extent, the case is that between those who believe in case-by-case decision-making, such as former Justice O'Connor or Justice Kennedy in many cases, and those justices who tend to believe more in bright-line rules, such as Justice Scalia, the epitome of that approach. In Justice Kennedy's opinion for the 5-4 majority, he uses the phrase exceptional, he uses the phrase extraordinary 5 times, he uses the phrase extreme facts repeatedly. He talks about the case shocks the conscious. So he's very much looking at this as a sort of a one-trip ticket, you might say. He even states at one point that the parties point to no other instance involving judicial campaign contributions that presents a potential for bias comparable to the circumstances of this case. In other words, this is the worst that has ever been seen, at least insofar as the justice seems to know of. So he wants to emphasize that this is sort of a one-time opinion. In response to that, Chief Justice Roberts, for the 4 members in dissent, raises 40 questions that he actually presents in list form, 40 different questions for the court that he believes are left unanswered. He begins, for example, with how much money is too much money? What level of contribution or expenditure gives rise to a probability of bias? Again, here Blankenship had spent approximately $3 million in various forms to try to support Benjamin's election. Roberts asks, how do we determine whether given expenditure is disproportionate, and disproportionate to what? He asks whether the amount in the case matters. Here we had about a $60 million jury verdict that was at issue. He said, what if the case was an employment dispute with only $10,000 at stake? Justice Roberts asks, among many other questions, how long does the probability of bias last? Does it matter whether the judge plans to run for re-election? Benjamin was elected to a 12-year term on the West Virginia Supreme Court, so he's got a long time before he has to run for re-election. There's some question as to whether he would still be so grateful for the contribution down the road. He asked about whether it matters that the judge has voted on other occasions against that party. For example, Benjamin, in several other cases before the West Virginia Supreme Court, had voted against Massey Cole. Massey is a regular player in West Virginia courts. It's one of the largest corporations in the state. One line in Caperton, the appellant's brief that I always thought was sort of humorous, he says, quote, a judge tainted by the probability of bias cannot constitutionally immunize his actions by the simple expedience of failing to vote in the manner that suggests bias. In other words, if we think you look biased, you can't get rid of that bias simply by not voting in a biased fashion. And so that indicates, I think, to some extent, the bizarre nature of this case. Roberts, again, asked many other questions, 40 all told. He asked where the case has to be. For example, the Massey case, it was widely expected that Massey would appeal In West Virginia, there is no intermediate appellate courts. A decision from a trial court goes straight to the West Virginia Supreme Court and is heard by that court. It's not a certiorari situation. On the other hand, at the time that Benjamin's campaign was underway and that Benjamin was elected, the trial judge had not yet ruled on post-trial motions, so it wasn't even absolutely clear how the judgment in the case would come out or that it would go to the West Virginia Supreme Court on appeal. Roberts asked whether one must assume a hostile judge would cause recusal. That is to say, if Benjamin had to recuse himself because Blankenship had spent so much money trying to elect Benjamin, had Benjamin lost and Justice McGraw sat in office still, would McGraw have had to recuse himself because Blankenship spent so much money trying to defeat McGraw? And I think that points to a very important issue in the case. If Benjamin's main goal was to get McGraw off the case, then under this rule, he would seem to have succeeded no matter which way the actual race came out. So a lot of questions that go into the case. I think in the end, when we take Kennedy's emphasis on the exceptional nature of the case and his emphasis of the extreme facts of the case, what we have here is really something of a one-off, almost the Bush v. Gore of judicial election and campaign jurisprudence. The court seems to be saying that this is not something that happens with any regularity and that we won't see it very often. Kennedy is careful not to suggest, and in fact to specifically deny, that campaign contributions generally create an appearance of bias in a judge that would require recusal by that judge. So it's a case that I think they try to hem in and say will be a narrow case. And its long-term impact will really depend, in fact, on, I think, what lower courts do with it and whether they interpret the case in that narrow way. It's a narrow precedent that would be a truly exceptional, a truly rare case. I do think we'll see quite a few motions that will come up for recusal in the aftermath of the case. But if the courts of appeals begin to slap those down, if other cases get to the Supreme Court and they knock it down, then I don't think Caperton will have much impact. It will be viewed as a one-off case on an extreme set of facts. The flip side is that if courts do begin to entertain these motions and do begin to suggest that recusal of various judges was constitutionally required, then I do think that the case is going to have a lot of administration problems. I think the many questions asked by the Chief Justice will come into play. And I think that the case is one that could actually produce quite a bit of mischief and perniciousness in confusing what are the general standards for recusal in a judge. This was a case, again, where we stressed that Justice Benjamin took no actions that would bring into play his bias. He had no direct pecuniary interest in the case, and so we're relying entirely on things beyond the justice's control to find that the justice has bias in the case that constitutionally requires his recusal. Potentially that's a big step. I think in the end it will be more like Bush v. Gore and we won't hear much from this case again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.